Remember to grab my water bottle? Forgot to get the mic on. Good morning. You can turn to Matthew chapter 28, last chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. If the Gospels ended with Jesus' death, we wouldn't call them Gospels, good news. If the Gospels didn't include Jesus' resurrection, if Jesus wasn't raised in the first place, we wouldn't have records about Jesus. We wouldn't have these books in the first place. Instead, if we had ever heard of him, had he not been raised, we would maybe say something about him being some good, if not obscure, good teacher who did some impressive things. But good teaching, high ideals, a good example, that's not enough to make a difference. If that's all Jesus ever was. Had he not been raised, we wouldn't be talking about him. We wouldn't be memorializing him. The world wouldn't have heard of him. There is no movement whatsoever without the resurrection. We're going to start off with chapter 28, verses 1 through 10. As we see the first witnesses to the most amazing event in history. Verse 1. Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he is risen. As he said, come see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead. And behold, he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him. See, I have told you." So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to the Galilee, and there they will see me." I think about those first witnesses, these women, disciples. Early that Sunday morning, what was their state of mind? I think about that time between Jesus' crucifixion and the resurrection, and some of the lowest, darkest days for people to have lived through. To have had so much hope in Jesus as the Messiah, to have given their lives over to him, and then to feel like they had been terribly wrong. Or that the Messiah had fallen short of his mission. In some small way, we've all had a taste of that darkness. When we feel distant from the reality of our hope, when all we might feel is the cross in our lives and not the hope in our lives, the futility, what was this all for? What is this all for? A lack of motivation. There would be no movement. For them, there is no movement, no motivation for us without this hope. We can even know what we believe in our minds. We can know what's right. We can know Jesus' teaching. And we know maybe how to go about it, but still lack the enthusiasm to act on it. When we're losing sight of the hope. So they arrive at the tomb, and if you read all the Gospels together, what it looks like is that Matthew is telling us the whole package all at once, without laying out the timeline for us. And so they get there, and the angel has, there's been quite a scene. There's been an earthquake, the angels have come and rolled away the stone, the soldiers become like dead men. You can read Luke 24 and John 20 for some of those details, as having been prior to the women's arrival. And now these women disciples show up, and this is the moment when everything changes. And they hear the first gospel sermon. Okay, I guess you can... I'm just teasing about that. But they do hear the first pronouncement that Jesus is raised. The empty tomb, to have arrived at the tomb empty, is not enough. It raises questions, but if I go to my grandma's gravesite and for some reason I see that it is empty, my first explanation isn't that her body is risen and that she's alive walking around somewhere. An empty tomb is important, but it's not the whole story. The angels didn't say, I know you see his body right here, but he's alive with us in our hearts. So the empty tomb is important. They weren't being told Jesus is alive spiritually only. They were saying his body has been raised. He is alive completely. Body and spirit. That's important for establishing the fact that Jesus has been raised. I think if people hear about Jesus' resurrection, they think, you know, some spirit was walking around and someone said they saw this ghost and now they believe. Well, you know how those things can go. How solid is that kind of evidence? But no, Jesus' body is raised, they're told. And so they don't just see an empty tomb and start wondering about Jesus's, they don't just see a tomb filled with a body and wonder about Jesus. That wouldn't change anything. And they don't just see an empty tomb. They are told positively what's happened. And they're told that they will be able to see him. It's not just that they're told that he's raised and they just got to trust that. They're told that they will see him. And they see him by the end of what we've read here. If they never saw him, and no one had ever claimed to see him, this movement would have gone nowhere. I think it's hard for us to appreciate, again, their state of mind, but they were not inclined to believe in the one who had been crucified, who had fallen short, who had failed as far as their expectations of the Messiah. It would take seeing him again for them to pick up this cause again. Now, once they're told, upon seeing the empty tomb, and they're told that he's risen, do they need to be told to go tell anyone else? There are times in the Gospels where Jesus tells people who are healed and things, don't tell anyone else, and people can't help it, and they go and tell others. But they're told, and of course they go. But it's automatic, isn't it? Don't you think it would be automatic? Well, Jesus was raised. They're not going to keep that to themselves. Of course they're going to go and tell others. And if we could say that about them, of course we could say that about us. I know it's not identical. I haven't seen Jesus in the flesh. But I do have this hope of resurrection. And I know of those who did say that they saw him. And how can I help? It's automatic that we go and tell others. And that's what I mean when I started off to talk about a movement. As we talked about in Bible class this morning, God moves things by people making disciples, by people telling others. And so there is a movement because they see and learn of the resurrection, and then they go and tell others. Jesus met them on the way. Not all the Gospels include that account. It's just amazing. They're going to tell others, and they see him. They're processing all of this. They're bewildered. There's fear and joy that they're experiencing right now. But then it's real. It's right in front of them. They see him alive again, removing all doubt. And he's risen. And they took hold of his feet, and they bowed before him. You might know this word worshipped in the ESV. It could mean just bow. It could mean honor as you would honor God, worship God. And some there's times in the Gospels where it might be used, and I'm like, I don't know if the person's meaning, it means that the person is intending to worship them or just honor them in some great way. I have a hard time not seeing worship here. Jesus, the Son of God, is risen. He's clearly greater than they had ever have imagined. And they worship him. But that's not the only story that's going to be told. There is a competing story for them and for us in our day. Let's read verses 11 through 15. While they were going, behold, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. And when they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers and said, "Tell people, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So they took the money and did as they were directed, and this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. So these are the guards who were made like dead men when they had experienced, I don't know what all they had recognized was happening when this angel came and this earthquake and the stone rolled away. But they became incapacitated. And now they bring whatever happened, whether, you know, they see the tomb's empty, obviously, at the end of that. They bring that report to the authorities. What would get them to agree to this lie? They'd experienced something insane. And now they're supposed to say that none of that happened, just disciples came and stole the body while we were asleep. Now, it's interesting, how did they know that disciples, how can they testify to disciples stealing the body if they are saying themselves that they were asleep? That's not a really solid case. How'd you know it was disciples? Who else would it be, I suppose? What they're saying, by saying they had fallen asleep and that this was stolen while they were failing at their duty of guarding this to protect against the concern that people might steal the body, to say all that would be self-incriminating to their role as guards to keep people from stealing the body. From what I've read, that could mean the death penalty for these guys. So that's why they have to be told, hey, we'll give you this large sum of money if you tell the way we want it told, and if the governor hears about it, we'll make sure this doesn't come back to hurt you. So they take the money. I'd love to spend time getting into arguments that Jesus actually rose from the dead and address the counter arguments. I've done that here before, and I'm sure I'll do it again. But I want to keep on moving with the text, and I'll assure you that I will be glad to hear your thoughts about that. I'm glad to talk to you about that. If there's any questions for you about that, there's lots of good material that I'd be happy to share and be happy to talk over that with you. But suffice it to say that there are hard historical facts associated with Jesus' resurrection, that people who believe the resurrection and people who don't agree that there's some facts that are undeniable, and that all the alternate stories to try to account for the resurrection, they can't account for those well-established facts. So, in case you don't happen to come and ask me, I will just name someone who's particularly useful at arguing this, and that it's William Lane Craig, is someone I find very helpful. William Lane Craig. There are others, but if you wanted to look up YouTube or something. But those alternate stories can't account for what we can discern from the basic criteria for establishing history. Paul said at some point in Acts, he said, "Why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead?" I find that a lot of times the reason why people walk away from being able to conclude that this is a true story is because of the assumptions they bring to it. Paul tells a Jewish audience of Pharisees and Sadducees who don't believe in the resurrection, Sadducees don't, "Why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead?" People come to it with a bias against God and his existence or his action in the world, and also assume that someone rising from the dead is the least likely possible thing to ever happen. But all you need is a God who raises him. If you allow for the possibility of God, that changes your whole perspective. People would believe the story and spread the story about people, disciples coming, overwhelming these guards, these trained guards, who are not overwhelming, just going through while they're asleep. And people would believe this. Not because it was a great case being made, but because it fits the world that they want to see. What do we do when there's a competing story? The women start to go out. They're going to tell other disciples. We're about to see the Great Commission of the apostles being sent out. What do we do? Because we do have that competing story. Some of you know that Subhash's dad preaches over in India. And Subhash has set up an opportunity for Anthony and me to join his dad's congregation now and then, virtually, and share lessons with people there. Some of those people, and my understanding is a good number of them, are people who are not Christians themselves. I mean, not Christians whatsoever, that still believe in Hindu gods, and they're attending this assembly. And so Nag, Subhash's dad, has this wonderful opportunity of being able to tell people the true story. They've got these other stories that they've grown up with about all these other gods. And he gets to tell them about Jesus the King. And we don't have just a story, not just a legend, but the true story that God became a man, the one and only true God became a man, died for us, the people who had sinned against him, who deserved his judgment. He died for us and he's raised. I have not, in my efforts to share lessons, have not had a wide experience with Hindu beliefs. I have touched on some things about India and Indian culture, but I haven't even scratched the surface. But I find comfort in the fact that I don't really have to know all the stories. I don't think any Hindu believer knows all the stories of various gods that are believed in. I don't have to know all the false stories to be able to tell the wonderful, beautiful, true story. It's going to be helpful to address some things, perhaps, and to correct them, but the greatest correction is in seeing how those things pale in comparison to the truth. But that's true for us, and with our neighbors, and our friends, and our relatives. They have their own stories, their own lies, their own way that they make sense of the world, and the way that they make sense of their successes, of their happiness, and the way that they make sense of tragedy, disappointment. And you know the truth. And you can think about how to address the false stories they tell themselves, about the ways that they reject Jesus as Lord, or the ways that they're ignorant of that. You can work on those things, and that will probably help, but by and large, what we do is we simply bring to them the truth, the true story, and let people see the beauty of it and the goodness of this God who's died for them, who has conquered death, and who can do the same for them. So how do we combat the lie? We can dismantle it, we can argue against it, but don't forget to simply make sure people hear the true story. So I want to spend most of my time, the rest of my time, on verses 16, I just say a longer portion of time, on verses 16 through 20. I don't have always a great sense of my timing here. Matthew 28, verse 16. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I am with you always, to the end of the age." Jesus had said, and you can read in chapter 26, verse 32, that Jesus had said that he, when he was raised, would go to Galilee. Remember, this is this region out away from Jerusalem where Jesus was raised, where he had spent most of his time during his 3 or so years of ministry. And these women, disciples, had been told to tell his disciples. It says, go tell the brothers. If you put there instead, the brethren, that's what that word tends to mean in Matthew. The couple of other times this happens in Matthew, Jesus, when he talks about the brothers, his brothers, he's talking about disciples, men and women, disciples. And so go and tell other disciples that I'm going to meet them in Galilee. I don't know that that's just the 11. We're told the 11 go there in this passage, but I don't know that that's just the 11. Jesus is setting an appointment ahead of time that they can tell each other about. If you read other Gospels, Luke and John, you see Jesus just sometimes just shows up when no one's expecting it. This is the time when Jesus said, "I will be there. Go there, and I'll meet you there." Again, with their propensity to share news with each other, I'm going to think that maybe more than just the 11 are here. And I don't know this for sure, obviously, but I think this is as good a candidate as we could find for that occurrence that Paul talked about in 1 Corinthians 15. Remember, he talks about all these different appearances of Jesus appearing to different people after he's been raised from the dead. And he says that in 1 Corinthians 15, rather, he says that 500 brethren at one time got to see him. 500 at one time. And when Paul's writing that, some 20 years later, he says that some of them are alive still. I'm just imagining being one of them. It's already enough for me that there were 11 apostles and these women who witness the risen Lord. But there's 500 people going around saying that they also, it's not just the small group, they also saw Jesus alive again. Not just a glimpse, but they were with him as he was alive again. And these 11, they come, they worshiped him again. It says some doubted. This could be a strong, like, I don't believe this is happening, as we read about Thomas. Or it could be just second guessing. I mean, again, they're processing all of this. What? Am I understanding this all right? Is this really what's going on here? And they get to be with him. Jesus says a lot of alls. All authority has been given to me. Go into all the nations and teach them to observe all I command. The one who had suffered under the authority of the Jewish leaders and the Roman leaders, the one who had been crucified and looked like he was powerless, is now standing before them, having conquered death in this now immortal body, and he's saying, all authority has been given to me. He had had authority before, but it does look like, as you read scriptures, that Jesus in his resurrection is that's expanded in some way, that the Father is giving some kind of greater realm of authority to be shared with his Son. He's enthroned, he's conquered death. And just imagining how reassuring this would be, how when they saw the authority and the powers that be crucifying Jesus, how wonderful then to say, it might look like right now that there are other authorities running things, but Jesus is alive and he's king. And that they felt that then, and we should feel that now. He is king now. And Jesus, then, who has all authority, gives this what we call the Great Commission. A little bit of grammar here. The main verb, the one main verb here, is make disciples. Not the way the English translations are saying, the way it's written in Greek. The main verb is make disciples. That's the main point. Okay. And then there's all these modifying participles. Okay. So there's going, make disciples. Make disciples, baptizing them. Make disciples, teaching them. So all these relate back to just the main idea of make disciples. So first of all, going. The translations aren't wrong by saying go and make, having two verbs there, because it, by being associated with the command, it is telling you to go. Going, when you go, make. Well, you're going to need to go. Sometimes there's debate about whether the Great Commission is just for the apostles or whether it includes us. I think when I've seen those discussions that really everyone really ultimately agrees on the implications. Christianity is not passive. It doesn't just sit and wait. They weren't told, you know, just raise families and make sure your kids are Christians and, you know, then it will grow. That's the hope. But we go. We go. Christianity is a movement. It is a cause. It is a conversion-oriented belief. And that isn't politically correct. To bring your beliefs to persuade others. Oh well. Of course, everyone does it, even though it's not politically correct. This doesn't mean we force our ideas on other people, at least not as far as I could understand the ideas of forcing ideas. Doesn't mean we hate people who disagree with us. It does mean we tell others the good news with the hope that they will believe and follow the King of Kings. And I know that even if we all agree about, hey, yeah, we do go, we do, we're not worried about being PC, there still can be something in us that says, it's just, I don't know, when will I have the open door where it feels comfortable to talk to this family member or this neighbor or this coworker? I don't know. You probably know I don't worry too much about things not being awkward. I do it in unimportant things. Surely I could be a little bit socially awkward if it means sharing my faith with someone else. Sometimes making disciples means we need to apply this going part of the command. Is it within the realm of possibility that you could decide where you live based on kingdom concerns primarily? Or even just in the top three concerns? That you don't just think about what works best for you and for your family in isolation from God's kingdom. That you don't just think about whether the kitchen has been working well for you. Or whether or not you want more acreage. Probably more stepping on my own toes there. I got a nice yard, I'm not complaining. But what if instead of, you know, moving because you have loud neighbors, for your loud neighbors and for the kingdom, you stayed and welcomed them into your home? Think about what it means for you to take on this great commission as a way of life. How will you go? So go. We got to go. And as we go in making disciples, we do that baptizing and teaching. It is a shame that baptism has been associated with so much disagreement and controversy over the centuries, at least latter centuries. But can it be that God commands us to be baptized for the forgiveness of sins? Can it be? Can we allow God to say that we are to be buried and raised with Christ in baptism? And that perhaps doing so, being baptized, is something we do from faith and not at all a way to earn our salvation? Can we make room to just simply say things as Scripture lays them out without adjusting them and thinking that Paul has bad theology or something? May we be content to present biblical baptism, doing our best to do so thoughtfully, to understand the people we're speaking to, and to do so humbly, so that we can teach others the way more accurately. The risen Lord commanded baptism without qualification as part of what it looks like to make disciples. And that's what we should be seeing as well. But not just baptizing. And someone made that point this morning in class. But teaching. And that was taken. That we don't just convert initially, but we build up and edify, and is surely part of the conversion idea more holistically. Make disciples, baptizing and teaching. Not just, by the way, teaching the information. People can have the right answers, and they can get them all down, in contrast to those people who have the wrong answers. But he says, teaching them to observe, to keep, literally, all that I have commanded you. Not to know, but to keep. It's not enough to baptize. When Andy Dieselkamp and Rick Legan and others made their trip to Sierra Leone, it wasn't just to baptize. In fact, from what I've heard, if they was all into baptize, I only heard about one baptism. It was to edify, equip, and encourage as well. To encourage those who had already been baptized into Christ. That's all part of the work of making disciples. And in those terms, both the work that they were blessed to do and the work that others are doing there, there's been great success and growth for the kingdom. We don't simply teach people how to be saved, but we teach them to observe all that Christ commands. People need to know what they're getting into. Doesn't mean that everyone who becomes a Christian foresees every possible sacrifice that they'll ever be asked to make. But it does mean that we commit to him as Lord no matter what possible sacrifice is ahead of me. I had a recent conversation about kind of rethinking, was I baptized for the right reasons? Was I baptized? People questioning whether baptism was understood everything, and whether or not they understood the commitment they were making. There are things we will not foresee, but we know who our Lord is, and that's what people need to understand, and that they are truly submitting to him, regardless of what that looks like in the future. So those are all the modifiers, but the main point again was make disciples. Make disciples. And we need that whole picture of what making disciples looks like. Perhaps some of you have read Dietrich Bonhoeffer's The Cost of Discipleship. It's a pretty famous work. He was a Lutheran writing in Germany in 1937. I have read the translated version. But let's think about that. A Lutheran writing in Germany in 1937. And in it, he criticizes the way that his denomination, the Lutherans, had converted most of the nation. But it's 1937 Germany. Would we think of that Christian nation as bearing the fruit of genuine Christian faith? Christianity, in name only, is horrendous. We all know that from history. Christianity in name only, not true conversion, not truly disciples being made, but just a bunch of baptized people. He was criticizing the fact that so many, this guy, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, was criticizing the fact that so many in Germany had been baptized but were not truly disciples. And so here's an excerpt from that. But do we also realize that this cheap grace has turned back upon us like a boomerang? The price we are having to pay today in the shape of the collapse of the organized church is only the inevitable consequence of our policy of making grace available to all at too low a cost. We gave away the word and sacraments wholesale. We baptized, confirmed, and absolved a whole nation unasked and without condition. Our humanitarian sentiment made us give that which was holy to the scornful and unbelieving. We poured forth unending streams of grace, but the call to follow Jesus in the narrow way was hardly ever heard. I don't think Dietrich Bonhoeffer is saying that the problem is too much grace. He calls it cheap grace, a grace that does not recognize the cost of our salvation in Christ's sacrifice and the corresponding life change that happens in his people. To talk about grace and not to talk about following Jesus through the narrow way is to talk about a cheapened grace. He says, what happened to all those warnings of Luther's against preaching the gospel in such a manner as to make men rest secure in their ungodly living? He was very good at criticizing the people in his circles. We need to be good at that. To criticize ourselves. We need to recognize that we can have the right doctrines in contrast to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the same problems of having the false security. We need to see fruit. And I see fruit. I don't think I'm coming down like, y'all are just a bunch of hypocrites. But we need to have a self-critical look in both being disciples and in our efforts in making disciples. We need to take care that our thinking about grace is not this cheap grace, but one that, again, takes into account the cross and our taking up our crosses. There are baptized people in churches all across America who are just that, baptized people, but not disciples. So may God help us to make true disciples. To back up to that lie being told about the disciples' body being stolen, how did the priests and elders get them to tell that lie? You remember? They reassured them they wouldn't get in trouble, but basically they gave them a lot of money. And they took that money. How does Jesus motivate his disciples to carry out the Great Commission? I mean, it's enough that it's true, isn't it? Jesus is raised. That ought to be automatic. But there's more to it, and that's the last words of the Gospel of Matthew. This is what should get us going. I am with you always, to the end of the age. That's not the words of someone on his deathbed with sentiment. That is the one who went through death, came out of the grave, And he means it when he says, I am with you always to the end of the age. And so may God help us to take that encouragement and to go and make disciples.